I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source Under the Jamaican Sun, sponsored by the Watson Institute at Brown University. We're engaged in an American conversation with global attitude. This Memorial Day weekend in America, which is Labor Day in Jamaica, we're listening in on Calabash 08, an international literary festival with a certain Bob Marley reggae feel about it. As the Calabash founders put it, it's got a reggae aesthetic of sensuality and social awareness applied to the spoken word of contemporary prose and poetry. Calabash and the Caribbean have a global feel too, as the exiled Nigerian poet now teaching in Los Angeles, Chris Abani, put it to the Calabash crowd. There would be no Nigeria without Jamaica. All the freedom movements in Africa, he said, began in the Caribbean. I came to Calabash looking for writers' angles on what the United States is going through in 2008, a presidential campaign year that also is clearly becoming an inflection point in all the world's thinking about race, power, globalization, among other things. I'm posting here a sort of composite conversation over 3 days with Calabashers. The thread is that old hope, as the Scots poet Robert Burns put it, to see ourselves as others see us. For starters, the novelist Margaret Cesar Thompson gave me the short course on the layering of Jamaican voices and identities. From her novel, The True History of Paradise, this was a piece spoken by a character born in China, Mr. Ho Sing, who came to Jamaica about a century ago to build his mixed-race family and his fortune.
Mr. Ho Sing. It was the same year Dark Star win the Kentucky Derby. Roy, him said to me, "What a horsey. Imagine if you was to own a horse like that, Mr. Ho Sing, how you would have feel." Me never really did see Dark Star for true. We just read about him and see him picture in the newspaper. Roy and me go Kimanis Park every Saturday. Him don't call me grandfather or papa or any of them thing. Everybody call me Mr. Ho Sing from time I reached Jamaica. You see, me was afraid to give me family name to the ship agent because I was Hakka, and a lot of people don't like Hakka them days in China. But that is another story. I was telling you how me, Mr. Ho Sing, who owned a grocery shop in Vineyard Town, did come to buy a thoroughbred racehorse. Not no face boy horse for breed and parade around. No, sir. A real champion. Marshall Bloom. From the minute Roy said that to me about Dark Star, the idea just snaps so in my head, and I don't stop till I bring the horse come from Ireland. I never think about racehorse till I turn old man after I meet Miss Rima. Before Rima was Lim Sue, and before Lim Sue was Pamela. Pamela was wife number one, and Lim Sue was wife number two. And before them was China. All right. I'm going to tell you how I reached Jamaica. But keep in mind, what I really want to tell you about is Miss Rima and Marshall Bloom and how a woman and a racehorse did make an old man life sweet.
So this seems to be the Jamaican secret, the kind of Creole adaptability of many, many, many tough people, gifted especially or challenged and triumphant in language.
I think you said that very, very well. It's exactly what it is. Tough in language. Survivors. I think Derek Walcott, the poet, often uses the metaphor of the castaway to describe the Caribbean people and the building of the Caribbean nations, that idea of castaways, of people who have, you know, come from all these various places, crossed many waters.
Margaret Cesar Thompson here on the shore of Treasure Beach in beautiful Jamaica. I keep thinking we're breathing Bob Marley's air here in your air. Account if you can for this Jamaican perspective. What is it all about?
Mixed up people. No, really. Many, many different layers of race and culture and many different histories all mixed together, I think. And it hasn't caused a weakening in a perspective or any kind of dilution. But I think we have very intense feelings about race, about politics, about tradition, cultures. But we have a way of allowing those things to be expressed side by side without great problem. And that's why these racial issues that come up now with the Obama campaign, for me as a Jamaican, it seems so naive. It seems naive to seem so completely shocked or overly fascinated by the idea that he's of mixed race, that he's representing both white and black. I mean, people in Jamaica have been thinking along those terms for centuries. Bob Marley has a white father, a black mother. I mean, it's, to me, and there have been, for centuries, African Americans have been dealing with the fact that they are of mixed ancestry, that they're in a sense a hybrid people. And what I love about Obama is that he's in a sense bringing this really forward, right, into the face of America, where it hasn't been dealt with before, I don't think.
There's this sense dawning in America in a number of books recently that we are a polyglot nation, really, 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 and that the Spanish and the Portuguese and the Dutch, as well as the English, settled and made the country. But it runs into sort of mythical obstacles too, doesn't it?
Mythical obstacles?
The notion of a Protestant Puritan English country that landed on Plymouth Rock in 1620, yeah, and lived happily ever after.
Yes. And again, that's about trying to sweep a lot of more painful history under the rug and not confront Native American, what happened with Native Americans, what's happened with slavery. But some great things have come out of all of that pain. You know, jazz, just for example.
Sports heroes of all kinds.
Yeah. I was explaining to my son at the time, he was about seven, about the African slave trade, because he was studying Ghana in school. And at first he said, "Mommy, that's a very sad story." And I said, "Yes, but if it weren't for the African slave trade, ultimately there would be no David Ortiz playing for the Red Sox today." So of course there's all that pain, but it's also the fruits of it all now, hundreds of years later, is that we have this, as you said, polyglot nation that can be just such a, I think the mix-up, as I call it, this is a Jamaican way of just talking about racial mixture, is a strength.
Margaret Cesar Thompson, help me out with a little hang-up in my own head. Jamaica always reminds me of Ireland. And it's sometimes the landscape, and it's sometimes the voice. But above all, it's the perspective on power. It's the kind of backstage, very penetrating, witty, ironic view of empire. Am I crazy?
No, it's absolutely true. In fact, I mentioned that in my first book, The True History of Paradise. One of the characters is looking around Jamaica and says, "It reminds me of Ireland."
Really?
Yeah. A lot of painful history. The sense of, the dominant British culture. Not just dominant in a physically violent way or anything, but in terms of having a superior view of its language and its culture, as opposed to, say, the Gaelic language. And James Joyce, Yeats, they all talked about this, about trying to revive Irish language and culture and how difficult that was in the face of British imperialism. And it's the same thing that Derek Walcott and the Caribbean writers have been doing. It's creating their own tradition, a uniquely Caribbean way of writing, Caribbean language, a different way of using English, for instance. But yeah, the landscape will remind you of Ireland, the goats running in the road, all of that. The fact that music is everywhere, just the people, the sort of laid-back way of the way, also the way that, I think the way in Ireland, the city is never that far from the rural. In Ireland, we have that in Jamaica too. You're not just a city person or a rural person. Everyone from the city has very close roots to the rural also. But it's that way of feeling as a previously colonial country that you're sort of inheriting culture secondhand. And then what are you going to do with that secondhand culture? You're going to make something fabulous out of it.
So take that Caribbean perspective, the language, the music, the distance, the closeness, the absolutely penetrating understanding of oppression and who's doing it. What is that Caribbean view of the States today? I must say, I come to a festival like this as much as anything to get a mirror on what the United States is going through. What does the Caribbean see? What does Jamaica see?
Well, I can't speak for all of Jamaica.
Oh, go ahead.
While I said that I thought, you know, there was something naive in being shocked or overly fascinated about the racial issues as though they weren't always going on, I also think there's something really wonderful happening right now, especially with the presence of Obama, because America is a great nation. It's a nation. Smaller nations look at America so they're looking in a mirror, in the mirror of the future, in the mirror of possibilities about what the world might mean in the future. I think Americans need to have faith in America. You know, faith that they need to be able to take a risk on the unknown, you know, on the unprecedented. And I mean, this is a great new age, the 21st century. You know, one of the things I thought when I, you know, Obama won that first primary, I thought, you know, growing up, I never thought the Berlin Wall was ever going to come down. I never thought apartheid was going to end in my lifetime. I never thought Mandela was going to be freed. All those things happened. Well, now I can also hope that Obama could be president of the United States in my lifetime. All the things that I thought were not possible actually just happened. They happened. They became real. And Obama's one of those things for me. He's like the Berlin Wall coming down.
How do you account for the power of his smile, the power of his presence, the power of his mind, with a man who has, in fact, had so little experience?
He's got a lot of intellectual energy. I think he's asking the right questions. There's something so new about him, and fearless. I guess too. That's what also. I think Americans like that about him. That he seems fearless. And so now I'm feeling too. We're on the brink of again showing, and I say it too because I'm now an American citizen also. Oh. I'm dual citizenship. We're on the brink of being able to show our best selves once again in this race.
That's very exciting, and you say it beautifully. Margaret Cesar Thompson, thank you.
Thank you.
Gerard Darnovan is a novelist born in the west of Ireland, now living in the American Midwest. He put a twist in that sense of an Irish angle of observation here in Jamaica. That liberated view from an island that found its own voice on the offshore of empire. Gerard Darnovan, I'm so happy to see a Galway man from the west of Ireland in this extraordinarily cosmopolitan circle of writers in Jamaica. What's the message from the west of Ireland?
The message from the west of Ireland is that there is some connection between the west of Ireland and Jamaica.
I felt it, but what is it?
I felt it almost immediately. You just walk down the road and you feel a kinship with people, and there's something in the DNA here.
There's something in the landscape. There's definitely something in the language. There's something in the relation to the Brits. There's something in the relation to imperialism and power. It goes pretty deep, I think.
Yeah, all occupied lands, I think, share a kinship. And obviously Ireland went through that for 600 years. And I don't know quite enough about the history of Jamaica, but I'm quite sure that many of the experiences are shared ones over the years, over the decades and centuries.
tell me I'm crazy, but I feel this sense that Jamaica, offshore island, knows the United States very well, a lot of coming and going in our television world, our phone world, our work world. Jamaica to the United States is rather as Ireland was for centuries to England, this kind of backstage, half admiring, half resentful, enormously witty and ironic observer of empire and power.
Yeah, it's a simple fact that, you know, Ireland did get the English language from the English and then improved it and gave it back to them. And I have this feeling that Jamaica has sort of an upsurge in music and poetry and song that is finding its own melody as they begin to gain in confidence. It's all about confidence. You know, a nation can lose its confidence, and it can gain its confidence, and with it comes the art of being able to tell your story and the story of people who've gone before you. And I do believe that artists do come from a particular country. They're not individuals. In the end, I think every writer comes from a place and ultimately writes about that place. And what I've seen here in Treasure Beach is writers who clearly feel that this is their home and who are giving and gaining great energy from that realization and celebrating it. I've never quite seen that before.
I came here to get the story, in a certain way, of the United States at this moment, to see ourselves as others see us, to see us in the near mirror of people who know us much better than we know them. But I put it to you, how does this American moment in 2008, May of a presidential campaign year, what's the story you see unfolding in the States? And how does it reverberate in a community of writers like this one?
I'm somewhat concerned that the United States that I went to, you know, 15, 18 years ago, has lost some of the very qualities that attracted me to the place. Mm. Its improvisation, its ability to make things up as it goes along, its ability to recreate things until they work. All that seems to have been lost, that those abilities, and people have polarized into very inflexible ways of thinking that is unhealthy, and I don't think it suits the character of the United States. Mm. I think that people are somehow yearning for certainty in a country that is based on the lack of certainty. Mm. And that was its prime attraction. Because with certainty comes a certain degradation of culture. And the United States has always somehow represented a mix of cultures, and that there is a certain level of uncertainty involved in living in the United States, and there is a certain cultural vacuum and a coldness that is part of the American way of life that you accept. And that's part of living there, and it's part of the excitement of living there. I feel that a lot of what's happened in the last 15 years or so has been a gradual siphoning away of those very qualities, and they've been replaced almost by a medieval European mindset. And I think it's a very dangerous one.
Can I turn it back, though, on you a little bit? To me, one of the striking silences in this world of the last 8-10 years, especially since 9/11, is the silence of the post-colonial writers, including the Irish writers and the Caribbean writers and the African writers and the Indian writers, who knew empire from under the heel of it, but have not really addressed the direction of the United States of America. Where are those voices making fun of domination, ridiculing it, among other things, reminding the states that Europe today is so much happier, a better place, among other things, more prosperous, since it gave up all that?
I think it's a lesson the United States is going to learn and is learning. That world domination, quote unquote, comes with a very heavy price tag. You end up destroying your own country. Ask any Roman general. And it just simply doesn't, it cannot be sustained. The amount of money it costs to even run one country that is not yours is staggering, as the U.S. is finding out in Iraq. And people are losing health care, or people never had it. People are falling between the cracks. They have no money. Entire communities in the Midwest have no money. They're poor. Poverty is endemic in the United States, and it's hidden. And it's hidden by the U.S. media. And wherever the U.S. media decides, the spotlight should shine, that's where it shines. Nobody questions, why isn't the spotlight here? Why isn't the spotlight there? I think the post-colonial writer is, from my understanding, is far too interested in the emerging self-confidence in his or own country and writing and celebrating that than being obsessed with. You know, if you become obsessed with something and writing, you know, you're writing about something either to reject it or celebrate it, it's really the same thing. You become tied to that subject. And I think that a lot of writers are simply finding more interesting things to write about in their own countries. And a lot of writers are writing from that new confidence that comes with a self-identity that is emerging rather than engaging with old identities.
You're talking about the people who stop drinking and go to AA, spend much more time in AA than they ever did drinking.
Exactly.
No, but come back to it. I've been listening since 9/11 for, shall we say, the Ondaatjes of the world, or the Salman Rushdies, or the Derek Walcotts, for that matter, or for the Irish writers to say, don't go that way, America. Don't do that British Empire thing again. It'll end in misery. And I haven't heard it.
It just doesn't interest me enough.
Really?
Yeah. The dominant feeling I have here is of people celebrating who they are, not, you know, and it's self-contained and it's self-generating.
Yeah.
And that's what's so exciting about it. It doesn't rely on the other for its energy. I think there are far more interesting things to write about. And I'm not sure that it constitutes a subject matter that would necessarily attract the, you know, writing minds to it. It's an abstraction.
They figured out something here, and I don't know what it is, but you said confidence, the assertiveness of speaking in their own voice over hundreds of years is extraordinary. What's the secret?
I think it's just, it's English, but it's our English now. And it's our melody, and it's our song. It's not yours, and it's a separation of language, and that's what's so wonderful about it. And it's an authentic language. It's not made up. It's not some artificial language created to satisfy an artificial culture that someone has deemed exists. This is the real thing, and that's what I'm sensing here.
Gerard Donovan, thank you enormously. It's a great pleasure to hear you on Open Source.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Beverly East is a best-selling novelist in Jamaica and a master of the many voices that we think of as Jamaican. She's also a courtroom handwriting expert who worked for many years in London and now lives in Washington. Beverly East, I'm so fascinated by this Jamaican voice, so confident in an alternative mode. What is that voice saying to the world these days, and most especially to the neighbor in the States?
Well, I like to think I'm tricultural, so although I was born here, raised in England, now living in America, I see the world in three-dimensional kind of thing. I consider myself a Jamaican, but when I'm lived in America, I'm very conscious that I'm an immigrant. I'm very conscious that I have this green card that Homeland Security at any point could slip, you know, take away from me. So I tiptoe gently when I'm in the States. I feel like I don't even want to get a ticket.
What's that about?
Since 9/11. I never felt that way until 9/11. And then I felt differently when the new Patriot Act came in and all these things. And then the DC sniper, with one of them being Jamaican, you know, you get a little nervous that everybody views you, that you are going to be the enemy, you are going to be the one that's got the drugs. And because I travel a lot, every time I'm coming through BWI or Dulles Airport, I'm going to be searched, I'm going to be questioned by my passport, because I travel a lot. I travel a lot because of my work. But I get this, I always feel I'm considered the drug mule, the alternative person that would be bringing the weed or the drugs into the country from Jamaica to the United States.
The thing that fascinates me is, how does an artist and a writer maintain her assertiveness and her confidence, her independence of view under that kind of pressure? And Jamaicans are famous for it.
Well, I think it's the way I was raised. You know, I was raised by really strong parents. So you, if you allow every little thing to buckle you, then you will buckle. And it's just a matter, you know your place in this world, you know you have something to do, you just get along and do it.
Let me ask, what's the difference between living in London, which you've done, and living in D.C.? I mean, two seats of empire, but very different.
I think the racism is more overt in the United States. Having lived in London, I think, you know, you manage to weave your way through, because I went through it as a child, so you see it from a different light. I was very much protected by the family that I grew up in. But when I came to the United States as an adult, I was so taken by the clear division of black and white. And I remember once someone came to my house, and the black woman that was in my house was surprised how comfortable I felt with this white woman that was also in my house. And she didn't speak. She just didn't speak at all, not to me or to the other woman that was in my house. But I try not to, you know, I have a teenage son, and I'm trying to raise him beyond this division of color. You know, my husband is, I should say my former husband, I just got divorced, I'm still, my former husband is raising him to be a black man in America, and I'm raising him to be a black man in the world, you know, because I think America is just one aspect of the world. And I want him to go anywhere in the world and feel he has a place, he can stand on his own. And I always say to him, if America gets too tough, you got Jamaica, you got England. When I speak to him about colour, he says he doesn't see colour. He sees everybody based on their personality and based on what he likes about them, and not whether they're black or they're white or anything. And I'm hoping that holds with him.
Now, is that the Jamaican benefit?
I think it's a Jamaican benefit. We are so multifaceted that we don't get caught up into, well, I'm black and I can't do this because I'm black, or I can't do this because I'm Jamaican. I think we go the other extreme. I'm Jamaican and I can do that. Of course I can do that.
And you do so many accents, so much patois, so many voices.
That's because I've lived, well, you know, if I was living in London, you know what I mean, it would be really difficult to sort of write a book if I had not come to Jamaica and tried to sort myself out and get me head around the actual crash. Well, you know what I mean. Listen, my Miss Ruby in my book, she's a damn troublemaker. Everybody know a Miss Ruby. So when they read my book, they know, say, them have one of them living at my house. I had a very cantankerous Miss Ruby living in my house. I don't want to say her name, but I just transferred her into my book. I can do the Queen's English, of course. Well, my dear, I love Jamaica so much. This is really my home. But, you know, we used to have elocution lessons when we were in London, because my mother did not want me to sound like an immigrant. So as a little girl, I had elocution lessons to be able to pronounce my words properly.
Tell America what it needs to hear here. In the middle of 2008, Beverly East, guide us.
I don't know if I'm in that position to guide you. I'm going to make some suggestions. Read more. Read more. Go beyond those cable channels. In America, you are taught about America. You're not taught about the rest of the world. So when people meet you, they ask you silly questions because they don't know anything else.
What's the silliest question you ever got?
Oh, do you have showers in your room, in your house? Well, to me, that's a silly, and that's from an adult. That's from an adult. When I got married, people viewed me and said, oh, she's very sophisticated, isn't she? And I'm like, well, what were you expecting? I didn't take it as a compliment. I mean, I didn't say anything because, of course, you know, my husband at the time was getting enough shit that he'd married an island girl. So, you know, but I felt that when you say to me, oh, you're very sophisticated, what the f- does that mean? Excuse my language. Explore more, travel more. The world is your oyster, so to speak. And there's so much to be gained and learned just by experience. Experience is your biggest teacher. And I find American people too parochial. They want to stay in the same place, or they go somewhere and then they order hamburger and they order what they know. You know, so it's just explore more, be more, read more, embrace more.
Beverly East, I embrace you. This is so much fun.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your time.
The poet Yusuf Komunyakaa had never been to Jamaica before. He's an American from Bogalusa, Louisiana. He won a Bronze Star in Vietnam and a Pulitzer Prize for his poetry in 1994. He is known as a jazz poet and a poet of war.
Well, I'm going to start by reading three sections from Love in a Time of War. Here, the old masters of shock and awe huddle in the war room, talking iron, far and sign, alloy and nomenclature. Their hearts lag against the bowstring as they daydream of Odysseus' bed. But to shoot an arrow through the bullseye of 12 axes lined up in a row is to sleep with one's eyes open. Yes, of course, there stands lovely Penelope like a trophy, still holding the brass key against her breast. How did the even star fall into that room? Lost between plot and loot, the plucked string turns into a lyre, a humming praises and curses to the unborn. When our hands caress bullets and grenades, or linger on the turrets and luminous wings of reconnaissance planes, we leave glimpses of ourselves on the polished hardness. We surrender skin, hair, sweat, and fingerprints. The assembly line, a hum to our touch, and the grinding wheels record our laments and laughter into the bright metal. Our touch, your face, your breast, the flower, holding the world in focus. We give ourselves to each other, letting the workday slide away. Afterwards, lying there facing the sky, I touch the crescent-shaped war wound. Yes, the oldest prayer is still in my fingertips. Someone's beating a prisoner. Someone's counting red leaves falling outside a clouded window in the secret country. Someone holds back a river, but the next rabbit jab makes him piss on the stone floor. The interrogator orders the man to dig his grave with a teaspoon. The one he loves, her name died last night on his tongue. To revive it, to take his mind off the electric wire, he almost said, there's a parrot in a blue house that knows the password, a woman's name.
Yusef Kumunyaka.
I come to Calabash, Yusef, for a perspective on us as Americans, what we're going through, mainly because I think the
island
wise men and wits see us better than we see ourselves sometimes. Start where you will. What do you learn about this very freighted year, 2008, in our own country, among these writers?
Well, I'm interested in the fact that that there's a kind of intellectual, psychological liberation happening in language. Art, in a way, centers us on needful dialogue. And I think maybe that is why Plato banished the poet from his ideal republic. The fact that in poetic language and quest, the questions are there. And for Plato's ideal republic, questions meant downfall of empire.
Connect that to our own ever endangered republic and our, what we've come to think of as our American empire. What are you learning? What are we learning about our own country in Jamaica this weekend?
We have to be able to dream. Not that all our dreams are fulfilled in any way, but I think it's a moment of intense dreaming. For me, I grew up in Louisiana in the segregated society in the 1950s, but I never really thought about the future early on. I had to read Baldwin in order to think about the future when I was 14. Coming in contact with Baldwin's Nobody Knows My Name and having Baldwin's photograph on the front of that book began my process of dreaming, basically.
You were reading a Baldwin biography the other day when I first met you. What would James Baldwin be saying about this moment?
I think Baldwin would be very forthright. I think Baldwin says somewhere that he was condemned. He was condemned to be a writer. Baldwin talks about the fact that in the South, the black man was always of discussion. In the North, never. Denied in one sense and exaggerated in another sense. So he was always engaging the national psyche. He was a dreamer. And that's what's interesting about America. America is really a composite of dreams.
I think of Baldwin as being that constant register of the American fixation on color and race. What would he be saying about this American moment of perhaps choosing a black president?
I think Baldwin would really embrace that moment, and in talking about it, he would have to embrace the number of changes that have happened within the context of the last 30 or 40 years, because there's been great changes to happen. So that's on a positive front. There's always the negative things as well. And I think we have extremely poor people in the United States, completely divorced of a pursuit of happiness for a simple reason. They don't have dreams. That is very devastating, especially when this deficit in dreaming is passed on to young people. For some young people, the only thing they inherit is rage.
What does it do for you, Yusef Kumunyaka, to come and commune with other mostly black writers from all over the world, in fact, here in the Caribbean? What do you take back? What resonates with you from the Caribbean perspective?
There seems to be a great celebration of the land,
That's very important. I grew up in the Deep South, a small town, Bogalusa, Louisiana, where I was taught to get my hands into the dirt. And I think that's very good. The land keeps us whole as human beings.
You say it very well. Yusuf Komunyakaa, it's a great pleasure to meet you and to hear you on Open Source.
Thank you.
Chris Abani was imprisoned for his outspokenly political early poetry in Nigeria. He remembers the music star Fela Kuti in the same lockup telling him, "Truth is a risky business." Abani himself is a very hot American literary star now, based in Los Angeles, still speaking truth to power.
Chris Abani, you bring Nigeria and Los Angeles to the many perspectives here at Calabash. What's the reflection here, do you think, and what's in your own head on the American moment, the Obama moment, the end of Bush moment?
Well, right now in Calabash, I'm just soaking up the sun and trying to forget all of that. But I think the end of Bush moment, the frenzy in America, is a very disingenuous frenzy. I think Americans voted this man in. When he clearly cheated on the first election, they did nothing to stop him. When he started a false war, they did nothing to impeach him. And it's sort of now easy to join the bandwagon of people calling for the end of Bush, or now distancing themselves from that. But all of America, even those who protested the war, because that is not enough, rode on America's empire. And this is what happens when empire fails. Everyone tries to get off the sinking ship. So, first of all, I really don't believe a single word about that. And I think what Obama offers America, and in many ways what Clinton, I think, offered America, is the chance to actually stand up and live all of the ideals of freedom that they're supposedly trying to put in the rest of the world. This would be a way to sort of revisit the trauma of race that has never been talked about. It's also about the possibility for a real change in consciousness, for the complete release of the idea of ownership that America has had, I think, over its black citizens. So it's a pivotal moment. Whether it will happen or not, we're still waiting to see.
People talk about Obama being ready, but of course it's a test of whether America is ready. What signs do you see of an American readiness to confront the underlying issues here?
For me also, the underlying issues are not even the question of race so much, right? America, what's really interesting is if you ask anyone else about America from any other part of the world, they always have a very nuanced response to you. They love Americans. They love the things about America that are beautiful, free trade, the sense of a freedom, the sense of an expansive mindset. They reject everything about American foreign policy. This ability to make distinctions about several Americannesses is something you will find almost everywhere else. The problem is Americans are not able to make that distinction about themselves. So you have the largest, most powerful democracy in the world that has no self-reflexivity.
Derek Walcott raised a fascinating question today. It had nothing to do with politics. He was speaking about an imperial culture of power and money and the responsibility of Jamaicans and Africans and even Americans to resist it. Mm-hmm. Does the Obama candidacy and all the excitement around it bear on the imperial question?
It does bear on the imperial question, because what happens is, and America will always deny the issue of class, but that what has always happened in America is that a certain kind of class has always been associated with a certain kind of race. And that class, those people have ruled the country, right? There are no, usually don't find a guy from Fresno whose dad just owned an orange plantation running for president. It just doesn't happen, regardless of the myth of the American dream. But what Obama represents, although he is upper middle class, is is a consciousness that itself has not been shaped by belonging entirely, either racially or by money or by privilege or even by location entirely to that class. So what you have now is the possibility of a president who's grown up in multiple cultures, has multiple race identities, multiple national relationships. And so what it does is it begins to bring nuance to empire and begins to break down the monolith of it, I think, and sort of begin to ask for more of a collaboration rather than the usual way of arriving with the gunships and taking over everything. I said America's a democracy that dictates the rest of the world how it should live.
Are you betting big hopes on this transitional year?
I have to, because I'm a poet, and that's what we do. We live entirely. I mean, why else would we make poetry? We live entirely in the moment of possibility, in complete optimism. But I saw what Bush did. You know, Bush essentially was moving towards what I would call an African dictatorship. You know, there's several steps. Step one is you try to change the constitution, right? He tried that several times. Step two, you declare war on a neighboring country or place so that you can divert interest. Step three, you create offshore prisons, right? This is all the stuff he's done. Guantanamo Bay reductions to Syria. Step four, you begin to limit habeas corpus. By the time you get to step 10, you have a full military dictatorship. And America was moving that way. And what was interesting is that American citizens just seemed completely apathetic to it.
Chris Abani, thank you for your poetry. Thank you for your witness and your testimony. It's a pleasure to hear you on Open Source.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Paul McCarthy edited these conversations. Christian Holland helped us post them. Meet our guests and leave a comment, please, at our website, www.radioopensource.org. Invite us to your own literary festival or suggest an angle or an author for another round of conversation. I'm Christopher Lydon, and I'm all ears at Open Source. Thanks for listening.